So, this afternoon I wanted to draw out a few more of the qualities of loving kindness. And I thought, I found myself a title, The Radically Inclusive Nature of Love. I like the sound of that. And I feel that it's an appropriate day to talk about that as well. Because we've just... The Radically Inclusive Nature of Love. Because in this day and age, it's radical to be inclusive, isn't it?
Yeah.
With all the political kind of rubbish that tries to divide us and, you know, the situations across the world that hopefully we don't kind of get swamped by, it's easy to start buying into this idea of division, of them and other, of being different. You know, even if we can say, oh, yeah, but we're really progressive, we like to include, we like to, you know, have people of different races, from different backgrounds, different languages. What about people who don't? What about people that we do exclude? You know, people with different political ideology. Or at least we can close our heart to those people and almost write them off. And one of the things about loving kindness, one of its definitions in the suttas, is sima sambheda. And sima sambheda means that which breaks boundaries and barriers between one another. And these are things that are artificially erected in the first place. You know, there aren't really many boundaries or barriers between us. Even borders between countries are just constructs, right? They're political constructs to say this nation is separate from this. I had the wonderful idea that a few people here were talking about to have a retreat on an archipelago. Is that the right word?
Between Finland and Sweden.
Yeah. And they couldn't quite decide if it was actually Finland or Sweden. I think you said it is Finnish. But it can be reached from both places. So what does it really matter where it belongs? The point is it's a place that we can meet and we can be united rather than divided and practice together in a way that includes as many people as possible. So somehow being inclusive is quite a radical and even subversive statement that goes against the way that politicians would like us to behave. You know, they try to control us through division, right? And we can say no. We can be intentionally inclusive and proactive about being inclusive. So I think for me, part of loving kindness is including more and more in my practice, including more and more people in my life. You know, we start from the easy people like we did today. Did you find someone to work with that was simple enough, easy enough? Anyone struggled with that? Wow. Your hearts are melting like the snow. This is wonderful. But we gradually expand the range of beings that we try to include. So we go from the love person to the so-called neutral person. Of course, nobody has an innate quality of neutrality or, you know, pleasantness or unpleasantness. Actually, it's all in our mind. But still, a person who, you know, maybe we don't really think very much about is the so-called neutral person. We don't have particularly strong likes or aversions towards this person. Maybe they don't matter very much to us. We don't necessarily have hopes and dreams with them. And so we just tend to let them pass by. We don't really notice them as they go about their life. And then, of course, there's the person we find really difficult to include, like, I'm guessing, a Donald Trump. I don't know, maybe some of you find that easy because, you know, obviously there's a lot of suffering there. In order to spread hate, one has to suffer, one has to be suffering. It's not possible to spread hate with a mind full of love. So we can at least have compassion for the difficult people, but eventually also realize that they're just trying in their own deluded, misguided way to find some happiness. And lo and behold, sometimes they really believe that what they're doing is right. I'm not sure there's anyone in the world that believes that what they're doing isn't right. They convince themselves, we all convince ourselves, that what we're doing is for the good, at least for our own good. And unfortunately, quite often we're working towards the absolute opposite end. So even the disliked people are human beings trying to find their comfort, their little happy place in this world. And most often we shut them out from our hearts. And we allow them to breed hate in us, as if that's going to be the answer. And of course, the Buddha said, hatred is never overcome by hate, but by love alone is it overcome. This is the eternal law. It's a law of nature, you know. As long as we so-called fight hate with hate, then the hate just increases. It consolidates. And in that sense, these people that would try to divide us have won. So for me, this gives me a lot of motivation, actually, with the project that I am involved in and with my life in general, to intentionally reach out to others and to include more and more of what maybe before I thought was unacceptable. One thing we spoke about yesterday also when I arrived here was, the monks that would keep women out of the Sangha. And somebody asked what they think. And often it's easy to see things that way. You know, what do they think? Those on the other side, this kind of amorphous group of non-individuals that we club together with people not like us. And one of the things that I've tried to guard my mind against is thinking in terms of they, you know, because as soon as I think in terms of they, I'm dehumanizing those people, the individuals concerned. And I don't know what each and every individual thinks. I doubt very much that each and every monk in the Sangha who has become part of a community that doesn't accept the full ordination of women, I'm not sure that each and every one is adamantly against it. In fact, I doubt it very much. But they're in a system where there's a certain amount of privilege, there's a certain amount of support that comes along from being in that organisation, from being in that club, if you like. And all of us are in our own little clubs, aren't we, where we get certain privileges. And therefore, we don't want to step out of line. And I think that's often the case with some monks who are not necessarily against the full ordination of women, but don't quite feel it's worth stepping out or risking their own feeling of belonging in that group. Because sometimes, again, like I said earlier today, genuine love is willing to sacrifice. And sometimes that means sacrificing some of our comfort, some of our privilege, some of our entitlement. And everybody in this room has a certain amount of privilege and entitlement, or you wouldn't be here. So is it possible to start using this privilege, using whatever security, whatever resources, whatever well-being we have for the benefit of others who are maybe not like us, you know, or who are, that's fine as well. But to include more and more beings. I remember somebody asked Ajahn Brown, several months ago, it was on a YouTube talk, I think. They said, well, what is the answer to all these problems in the world? And I loved his answer, actually. It was very simple, very practical. He said, travel. Travel. Get out of your known situation, your culture, and go and meet people in different parts of the world. And I thought it's so true because I started travelling when I was 18. I went to Israel because I wanted to live in a different kind of society. So I joined in a kibbutz for a short time. Actually, it was meant to be 3 months and they asked me to leave because I wasn't fitting in with the other British people. I didn't want to drink and play cards. Anyway, I think that's why, because they didn't give me any other reason. But it was good for me because then I was, you know, just out travelling alone and I got the travel bug. So the next year, myself and my best friend got a little braver and we took a one-way ticket to London. Sorry, from London. That's not very brave, is it? From London. We're from a small town in the north, so we first had to get to London. And that was pretty cool because whenever you went into London, suddenly there were all these different colours. And in Chesterfield, where I grew up, it was mainly white and it was very boring. And I felt quite narrow-minded as well. The town, that is. So as soon as we go to London, we'd feel like, yeah, this is much better. This feels like the world coming together. And anyway, from London, we went to Thailand, but we had a one-way ticket that ended We went first to India, and we had a one-way ticket that ended in Thailand, and actually no more money after that. So that was the start of my adult life. And I mean, it completely turns your world inside out and upside down in all the best possible ways for me. I guess now looking back, I think, oh, my poor mother, she really did have to have a mother's unconditional love. and a lot of patience and a lot of forgiveness to deal with the worry that I must have caused her by being so far away. I only managed to get to a phone probably once a month at best, and you had to kind of stand in a queue in the International Telegraph office in a capital city like New Delhi, and you had like 5 or 10 minutes to talk. So it was just enough to say, I'm here, I'm alive, next we're going to such and such a place, and I'll try and send you an aerogram from there. So the aerograms would take 2 weeks, and she'd have to presume in between that I was still alive and nothing terrible had happened. But for me, it was just wonderful, and I started to get into the Dhamma there and also serve on retreats, and we had people coming from every possible walk of life. There was always a delegation of foreigners, overseas people from, again, most countries in the world. We had a group of Iranians, we had a group of Russians, a lot of Israelis were travelling in India at that time, kind of, what do you call it, decompressing or trying to heal the trauma of being called up into the army. I met some who'd actually absconded by, is that the right word? By saying that they were somehow mentally unstable because they had no choice but to join. So a lot of them were quite fired up. But one of the ways they dealt with that was going on these retreats. And of course we had Indians from every walk of life because the retreats were donation basis, and it meant that people even from the smallest and poorest villages could come. Some would offer them a train ticket, and they travel in the third class train on the upper berth with all the goats and chickens. And then they'd come to these retreats. There was even a group of Jaina monks and nuns on one of the retreats, and they came with their white robes. They'd walked there barefoot, and they had their they have like a brush with very, very fine sort of almost like hair rather than straw. And then they, before they sit down, they would lift up the cushion and then sweep any possible invisible beings that might be underneath. So they take the precept of protecting life almost to an extreme. The Buddha said it's enough to protect the life of visible beings, but these Jaina monks and nuns, they would actually try to sweep in front of them wherever they walked and also under the cushion. And actually, I picked that habit up because once in Burma, I looked under my cushion before I sat down, and there was a tiny snake, like tiny, coiled up, like a baby snake, basically, under my seat. So luckily I could sweep it up and let it live. So that's quite a nice practice, but I think here you don't have to worry about it. So travelling is a really wonderful way to start seeing that wherever you go, human minds, human beings are the same. And I would serve on these retreats, which were very uniform. It was the same instruction. Day one, you get this instruction. Day three, this instruction. Day six, it's this discourse. Day 10, this chanting. It's the same wherever you go, but translated into different languages. And I started to notice that people's process was pretty much the same. They'd go through some sort of tiredness, some haziness. The mind would start chatting a lot. They might go through some really kind of stormy, kind of emotional turbulence. And interestingly, on the retreats, people had seemed to go through a similar thing. They'd sort of, it'd be contagious in a way. And by the end, they'd be feeling like, wow, they've really understood something about the mind. And people would come out of these retreats practicing metta, having practiced metta, and start to talk and share. And the conversation really did transcend race and age and gender and all of that. We didn't even bother with it, our names, you know. It was just a sharing of what we've discovered about the way this body-mind process actually works. And this really starts to open the mind and break down any sort of delusion about people being particularly different. Sure, there might be some cultural traits that are stronger in some places than in others, but you can easily attribute that to the way we've been raised or to the climate or whatever it is. And so for me, my world was, you know, it started to become really quite vast. And I'm so grateful for that. And if you can't travel, you know, we can actively seek to hear the experience of other people who are not like us. One of my friends in Perth was reading a book by a woman from Gaza about her culture, her family traditions, you know, the kind of customs they have over there, because she wanted to understand, she wanted to put a face to what's actually happening over there. And I found a piece of research that was interesting. It was called the identifiable victim effect. Victim's a bit of a strange word, but you can understand what we're talking about when people are being persecuted. You know, we can say that these are, at that time, victims of those who are perpetrating harm. And the identifiable victim effect is basically pointing out that we respond when we have a connection with a person, when we can see a person as a human being just like us, we generate compassion for their situation. When you hear about this group of people over here in a country you've never visited, or even this person over here from a country somewhere else who you don't know their name, their age, their gender, there is less empathy and therefore less compassion available, and people don't donate as much. So that's why all the, you know, kind of charities that try to get funding for humanitarian projects, they always have, or ideally should have, a picture of a person and a little bit about their story, about their background, so that we can start to identify with them. You know, we need to find that common identification, which has been found out to be one of the components of compassion. Seeing others, seeing our common humanity and being able to identify with one another. So again, this is part of right view, understanding that essentially we're all suffering, we all experience suffering, and we're all looking for peace, we're all looking for love, right? Who can survive without love? What would a life of love look like? It's kind of unimaginable to me. I wanted to share a little poem as well that just explains this kind of gradual widening of the sphere of love. And this is a poem that Ajahn Brahm put on his website when he did the bhikkhuni ordinations in Perth. Do people know a bit about all of this history that happened? When he didn't actually ordain women, but Ajahn Brahm is my teacher. He's a monk from England who's been living... He was living in Thailand, trained with Ajahn Chah for about 9 years, and then has been in Perth in Australia since 1983. And he too was kind of used to just being in a monk-only monastery until he started meeting women who started saying, well, we too want to be ordained. And he's told me recently that I have to be really grateful to this particular bhikkhuni, because he told me recently that it was actually a Mahayana bhikkhuni called Yifa. So he calls her Yiha, because he likes to have fun. But it's Venerable Yifa. And they were at a conference, I think, in 2007, not the Hamburg one with the Dalai Lama, but another one. And somebody asked him about, you know, women being able to take the full ordination. And he said something like, oh, yes, I suppose they can do that. I'm sure we can find a way. And she stood up and said, Ajahn Brahm, that is so patronizing to women. And afterwards, he was sitting at a table with her and some other really strong women, like, who was there? Not Tenzin Palmer, but was it Tenzin Palmer? Oh, I forget. Anyway, some other really strong women. I think Venerable Dhammananda was there, who's the first Thai bhikkhuni, so she's pretty fierce in a sense, you know, strong pioneer. And he was sitting with these four kind of strong women, all either bhikkhunis already or asking about the full ordination. And he just realized they were completely right, that he was being patronizing and that there was no, it wasn't up to him to grant them ordination. It's actually something that the Buddha set up long, long ago. Anyway, so when he did finally come to do the bhikkhuni ordinations in Perth, he got into trouble by the boys' club. And they told him, you've been a bad boy, called him to Thailand and said, don't do that again. If you admit that these women are not really ordained, we'll let you stay as part of the community, part of the organization, the Wat Pa Pong branch of monasteries. But if you do say that they're fully ordained and if you stick by them, then you're out. So he had this moment, this one of these pivotal moments in one's life where he had to do the right thing by his own moral conscience, knowing that he was going to lose a great deal and not even knowing, to be honest, if the monastery would continue to thrive. And he said, well, I just can't do that. These women are bhikkhunis. They've been ordained properly according to the Vinaya. And I stand by what I've done. So they threw him out. And he put this lovely poem on his website, which really encapsulates loving kindness for me, because it's not aggressive, but it's clear. It said, "They drew a circle to shut me out. Rebel, heretic, a thing to flout. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle that took them in." Isn't that great? So your circle can be this big and shutting everyone else out, or you can just expand it. You include those people that shut you out. And another important thing is that you don't have to be around the people that are unsafe for you to be around. It doesn't mean that you've got to go and shake hands with someone who is likely to then turn violent or abuse you in some way, of course. You can love them from a distance. You can develop thoughts and feelings of loving kindness when you feel safe, when you feel nourished inside. And again, bit by bit by bit, you put the kindling on the fire first of all, and then the small wood, and then the bigger wood, and eventually the big soppy logs. And the fire is so strong by them, it can dry them out, and they can take the fire, they can take the heat of loving kindness. And there's no need to go too fast. I had a situation with a friend, a really close friend, who was a nun with me in Myanmar. And I didn't realise that there were significant... I guess I should have known that she had quite a lot of childhood trauma. I knew her story. But I never expected it could be taken out on me because I was the friend. And then when things became very difficult for us as nuns and we were sort of a bit stuck for somewhere to go and I was starting to think about going to Australia, we had a little kind of argument, nothing big, and she actually came to strangle me. And she actually strangled me with her two hands around my neck and her thumbs pressed into my neck and shook me by the neck. And I was just in such shock that I didn't even fight back. I was just like going backwards and forwards and looking her in the eyes thinking, wow, is she going to let go soon? Because I'm feeling dizzy. And it was probably the most traumatic event of my life. I hope this isn't too traumatizing for anyone here. I should say trigger warning, perhaps. But I feel good with this now. And the reason why is because of loving kindness and not loving kindness to her. I never actually practiced loving kindness to her. I remember her writing to me afterwards without addressing what had happened, without apologizing or wanting to go there, just saying, we've got to just send loving kindness to each other. And I thought, no, I don't want to bring up your face in my mind because I saw the hate in her face. I don't want to kind of re-traumatize myself in that way. So I'm just going to leave it aside and carry on my practice, continue, you know, being in monasteries, surrounding myself with good people. And then about 2 years later, at that time, you know, talking about it would actually cause my heart to start to race. And it wasn't even the physical impact. It was the fact that this could happen from a friend. It kind of shook my worldview to a great extent because friendship for me had been the purest kind of love in my life. So one day I was practicing loving kindness. It was a self-retreat of maybe 2 or 3 weeks. And I was practicing loving kindness to my best friend whose birthday it was. And the loving kindness was really flowing. I was kind of in this beautiful kind of golden, melty kind of world where there was just so much well-being and so much gladness and peace in the heart. And without even trying, this person came to mind. They just kind of popped in. And it was as if they just joined this flow of kind of love that was pouring out quite effortlessly by now. And the remarkable thing about it was that when they arose in my mind and they kind of joined in this flow of love and kindness, it didn't even have the slightest impact. She just got carried along in the flow. And it was beautiful. It seemed to... I mean, it wasn't like anything significant happened. It was just the fact that it didn't impact me. And there seemed to be enough love to share. And then after that meditation, my whole relationship to that experience and to her had completely transformed. And I could talk about it in a relaxed way. I could think about her wishing her well. Again, I didn't intentionally send her loving kindness, I don't think ever, but even now when I speak about her, I really wish her well. And it is just remarkable, the effect of loving kindness. Another of the qualities of loving kindness is apamana, which means boundless, immeasurable love. And also a kind of impartial love. So it's like the sun that shines on all beings equally. It leaves no place untouched. It leaves no one out from its rays. And that's how it felt to me. It felt like there was so much metta going around that it could include her there as well. There's another lovely simile in the suttas called the salt crystal, the simile of the salt crystal. Does anyone know this? Or the lump of salt? I'm sure that some of you Pali folks might know. It's really nice because this is sort of what happens to the mind when the mind is suffused with loving kindness. So the Buddha says, he's talking about karma and the effects of karma. And he's trying to point out that we don't always experience karma in the way we expect. It's not that if we do something terrible, we'll necessarily suffer to the same degree. It's not necessarily the case if we do something good, we'll feel immediately happy about it. It depends also on what's arising in the present moment. In other words, it depends on the past karma coming to fruition, the nature of that karma, but also the mind it meets in the present, the quality of the mind it arises within. Yeah? So going back to that simile, it's like the story of my friend. When my mind was small and still quite wounded and very shaken by this, my mind was small. And if the past memory would come up, it would have a big impact. But when the mind was wide, when the mind was expansive, it didn't have the same effect at all, right? So the Buddha likens this to putting a salt crystal in a glass of water. If it's just a small amount of water, that water becomes far too salty to drink. But if you take that same salt crystal and put it in a big lake, like the lake outside, you don't even notice the salt. And it's the same thing with our karma. We might think we've done things in the past that we're not very proud about. We might have, I'm sure, done many things in past lives, if you believe it or not, that we don't even know about. Who knows what we may have done? But if we have a mind in the present that is wide, expansive, immeasurable, suffused with loving kindness, then when a thought from the past or some past karma arises for us, it won't have so much effect. The sheer quantity of goodness far overpowers that little bit of pain or anxiety or whatever it is. So we have this way of being able to embrace these things fairly easily compared to when the mind is small. Does that make sense? And the Buddha says that a mind in samadhi states is mahagata, is gone to greatness. So the mind itself becomes vast. So I wanted to talk a bit more today now about how we can use the same kind of understanding of inclusivity and including different kinds of people towards including more of ourselves in the field of our own loving kindness, because this is often the hardest thing to do. And this was actually inspired by someone sitting very close to me in the room who asked me, she said, well, the loved person, the neutral person, the difficult person, don't they all live inside of us? And it's true, isn't it? Don't we have a part of ourselves that we like? And another part that we couldn't care too much for. Or even some parts of ourselves that we simply cannot accept. So in a way, the loved person or the liked person, the neutral person and the enemy, they all live inside us. And in a way, that's why we have issues with the enemy outside. We haven't made peace with those things in ourselves. So what if we could turn this radically inclusive nature of love inward? To include more and more of ourselves so that no part of ourselves is left outside of the warmth of the sun. Yeah. It's like sometimes we become so kind of, I don't know, full of shame or full of tension. Our minds are like a screwed up piece of paper, really tight. you know, and we don't even know what's inside because we can't quite open that piece of paper. We don't see, you know, that maybe inside there's some beautiful drawings on that paper or some lovely words of loving kindness or something. Our minds are just scrunched up too tight. So we need to start opening up that paper. Another example I like to use is using this idea of kindfulness. Kindfulness being like the light and the warmth of the sun. It's like the light is falling on a little fern in the forest. You must have lots of ferns here, right? Good. So it's a good Finnish example. And this little fern is so small and so tightly coiled up, you don't even really notice it. You don't really see what it's going to be. You can't see its potential. So first of all, the light has to shine on it. And then along with the warmth, the sunshine carries the warmth innately within it. It starts to unfurl and you start to see the fern open up. So we need to start doing this to our minds as well and to our bodies. And again, we have to use this beautiful combination of mindfulness and kindness together so that wherever that light shines, it carries with it the warmth. In the same way, wherever our awareness falls, whether it's on our body or on our mental world, it becomes almost like a vehicle through which that kindness can flow. You first make contact with, say, a painful part in the body, and then we develop a good relationship with that body part. So once we're aware of it, we can actually send it some warmth, send it some kindness. And this starts to open it up. So this is not for the sake of softening pain or softening anger. It's more to understand what's going on. Of course, these things will soften and disappear in their own time anyway through the power of this kindfulness. But the Buddha said in the First Noble Truth that there is suffering and suffering's to be understood. Yes, there's an end of suffering too, but the end of suffering comes through understanding suffering, not through avoiding it. And this is a very, in a way, obvious point, but it's also a subtle point because we have this inbuilt, it's like our brains are primed to avoid pain. So in a way, we're changing our kind of our brains, the way our brains have been built to react to pain, whether emotional or physical pain, right? We've got this kind of safety mechanism that completely exaggerates the threat. It's like this fight-flight kind of mechanism that, you know, animals have. We still have that very strong. So when we feel something that's unpleasant, our immediate instinct is just to get away from it. And if we're doing this for our whole lives, we never really come to understand what it is that we're reacting to. And sometimes what we think is a monster is just a little soft, fluffy mouse. It's actually not harmful in any way. It's just our conditioned response to recoil from pain, to withdraw from anxiety, to think there's something wrong with us. So it's quite, again, radical what we're doing. We're actually transforming the way our brains work, essentially. And of course, that the brain is not the mind. So the brain is just a kind of physical lump of matter that, in a way, filters the mind. So the mind is much bigger than the brain. The mind is beyond the brain, and we're purifying the mind, which will also relax these systems in the brain, these fight-flight responses. I mean, this is very, very kind of simplistic way to explain it, but we can talk more about that later if you want, because there's some interesting research on the role of the mind and the brain and the relationship there. So when we're working with the body, it's important to be very, very gentle and very respectful to our body and to the feelings in the body. It can help sometimes to have feelings of gratitude towards the parts of the body that are well, that are good, that don't hurt, right? I know you hurt your wrist, and it must be quite easy sometimes to feel a bit irritated because it takes so long to knit together again, but just to feel grateful for the fact that our bodies do heal themselves. You know, several years ago, I showed some of you my cool scar. I have a really cool scar here. I had a melanoma, which is actually really dangerous. If you find it in time, you're fine. And it was found at stage 0. I didn't know there was a stage 0, but anyway, that was all very good. But after I had it removed, I thought it was all going well, and then I opened up the dressing and it was all infected. I thought, okay, I'll let my immune system deal with it, but it wasn't dealing with it very well, and it got worse and worse. So I decided to meditate on loving kindness. And I remember sitting for about 3 or 4 hours just practicing love intentionally towards that part of my body. Actually, just generally, but from time to time, sending it to that place. And lo and behold, in a day or two, it started to heal just through the power of loving kindness. But it has to be genuine. It can't be love in order to get rid of. It has to be love like, I accept you, I respect you, may you be well, may you be happy, may you be at peace. Sometimes we can be sitting somewhere uncomfortable. I was ordained in Myanmar in 2006, actually also in 2004, but I had to finish my degree, which I thought I ought to do. And then I went back in 2006. And from time to time, we'd get into Yangon and we'd go and meditate on the Shwedagon Pagoda, which was, it's just one of, I think it should be one of the wonders of the world. I'm not sure it is or not. It's about 90 meters high, and it's this gold-plated kind of pagoda that is on this marble platform above the city with four huge staircases going up to it. I mean, it's quite a climb. And around the outside, there are just so many stupas and temples and places to meditate and people meditating and doing devotional worship, chanting the suttas all day and probably all night. And it has just this powerful energy, but the only thing you have to sit on is stone-cold marble. Actually, it's not even cold enough because Myanmar's very hot, but it's hard. And I remember just sitting on this with my bony ankles and thinking, gosh, how am I going to manage this? But then closing my eyes and just getting overwhelmed with feelings of gratitude and peace and devotion and all these good qualities. And after a few minutes, the body just melted, and it was as though I was sitting on cotton wool. It was so beautiful. So sometimes metta means just leaving things alone. You know, just trusting that your body is going to find its ease, developing good intentions, developing a sense of gratitude just for the opportunity to sit with spiritual friends, or in that case, to sit in such a highly charged devotional place. And amazingly, you know, this hard marble seemed to turn into clouds, into cotton wool. So it's very interesting. Perception shifts. You know, what we think is unpleasant actually starts to become pleasant when we relate to it wisely, with the right attitude. And it's the same with our emotional world. You know, it's very common. I've heard a lot of people say, I struggle with grief. I struggle with anxiety. I struggle with whatever, depression. And it's quite obvious to me from that sentence that the problem is not the depression or the grief or the anxiety. Do you know what the problem is?
The struggle.
The struggle. The struggle. It's the negativity about the negativity, if it is a negativity at all. It's getting negative towards an emotion that to you, you're judging as negative. The word apamana, this measurelessness, also means without judgment. It means not measuring, not judging anything at all. You don't say it's good or it's bad. It's just what it is. Depression is depression. Grief is grief. Just because you're a Buddhist doesn't mean you're not going to have grief. I can tell you now, and I can ask for your support, when my teacher Ajahn Brahm dies, it's going to be the hardest thing I have to face in my whole life, and I'm going to grieve. Because the extent of grief is proportionate to how deeply you loved. Perhaps my love isn't entirely free from attachment to my teacher, because that's a certain stage on the path where we need our Kalyanamitas, we need our teachers, and I'm surely going to grieve. And I'm going to try my best to welcome that grief and to also help normalize these emotions for other people, because I found that as a teacher, one of the most inspiring things I can do is not tell everyone about all my deep meditation, which I'm not allowed to do anyway, but actually talk about the very human emotions that I experience. And people have said to me, wow, it's amazing. It's so good to hear that even after 20 years, nearly 20 years as a nun, and 28 years, nearly 30 years of practice, you still get the hindrances. It's like, yeah, I'm a human being. One person who's actually now a monk, he came to our online retreat and he'd been listening to Ajahn Brahm for years and not getting a lot of success. And he came to our online retreat and I'm quite good at talking about working with the hindrances. And he was so inspired. He said exactly that. He said, "It was so good to hear you talk about this. I'm so inspired. I'm sending you £10,000. And he sent us a £10,000 donation before he took the robes. And I'll never forget that. You know, it was so inspiring to me to realize that it can be inspiring just to be real. This is what it means about including, right? Including everything. Don't stigmatize your emotions. Don't stigmatize your mind. You're a human being, and it's so beautiful. It's a sign of strength if we can be vulnerable with ourselves, with others. There's been times I remember in Perth at Dharmasara Monastery that I was really struggling. And sometimes I was feeling so shaky when I would come down to breakfast or something like this. And I'd think, oh gosh, I've got to go and see all these people. I don't know if they really accept me or not. I'm not quite right for this place. And they don't really include me the way I want to be included. It was bringing up quite a lot of feelings of rejection somehow. And I knew it was related a little bit to other things. But I just made a decision. Well, you've got to go and have your breakfast. So just try to stay open with this sense of vulnerability. Just try and go and include it. And even tell people about it. And that's what I did. And of course, from that time that I started to talk about how I was feeling, I started to make lots of friends. And I remember actually Venerable Upeka, who you know very well, who came to stay with me twice now, she said to me, she came to my cootie once because she'd done something that she felt she shouldn't have done that might have hurt me, or said something that might have hurt me. And she said, "Inspired by your example, I've come here to be vulnerable. I need to tell you something. I need to be vulnerable with you." And she told me that she'd, I don't know, said something about me. I don't know. I don't even remember because I didn't feel any ill will. I was just really impressed that she could come. I felt really grateful that she found me safe enough to confide in. And that was an example of how vulnerability connects. It connects us to our common humanity once again. So see if you can develop a wise relationship, a respectful, a loving, a caring relationship with your emotions. If that's not possible, an attitude of curiosity. You know, can we actually sit with ourselves and say, okay, this is interesting, tell me more. You know, you've got something bubbling up, it feels a little bit disconcerting or you're feeling a little ill at ease. Oh, let me listen to you. Tell me what you need to say. Of course, you don't have to actually speak to your emotions literally using words, right? And certainly not in public. Although maybe it's okay. But you can actually learn to have a different dialogue. Because quite often, we're thwarted by this thing called the inner critic. Oh, this always happens to me. I'm hopeless. Why is this still happening? For goodness sake, I should know better. I should be beyond it. Should. Whenever there's a word should in your mind, you can know this is the inner critic. This is Mara. There's no such thing as should. The Buddha's pointing us to the reality as it is right now. Not to anything that should. Right? Who says it should or it shouldn't? This is nature manifesting in front of our eyes, and we are here simply to learn. So again, see if we can notice when we're struggling with something or when we're using words like fight. You know, they always say, oh, such and such is fighting cancer. They won the battle or they lost the battle with cancer. I always think, my goodness, poor cancer. It just wants a little bit of TLC. Why don't we fight these things? It probably arose in the first place because we were fighting our body, we were fighting our need for rest, we were fighting, you know, our need to resource ourselves at the proper time or to eat the right food. It would have been good. And this is not to blame anyone. You're going to get, most people get cancer actually, no matter how they live. But we can also develop a sense of, I mean, this is not easy, and I can't really speak from experience because I had a cancer that was taken out quite quickly. But it did give me the opportunity, even in that short time, to go through some fear and to have a sense of the incredible gift that is life. Because until then, I kind of thought I was cool to go at any time. I just thought, yeah, I'm not really attached to my body. And then when this happened to me, I realized, actually, I do want to be here to serve, not only to meditate and get enlightened, but to continue serving in the project. And at that point, actually, it was a very, very difficult few years, actually nearly 10 years. And I thought that if, you know, I was going to die, that I would just ditch everything and just meditate for the rest of my life. But when I had this melanoma, I realized that actually, no, I would carry on and I would serve and I would try to leave something behind for others. And it brought me in touch with how much I really love and value what I do. And I remember saying to myself, try not to forget that, you know, try to remember that. Because we can get so bogged down in the nitty-gritty of everyday life, we just don't value all the opportunities we have to really do good and to really give our love in whatever capacity we can through our livelihood, relationships, or just through our attitude to ourselves and to those we meet, even to the things we use. Yeah. So love and kindness is a disposition to life. It's an attitude, as well as an action. And it can spread to absolutely anything. So, with these words on the inclusivity of love, I would like to invite us to do some meditation.